The new season of Famous Fate, titled Falls from Grace, is underway. Every Wednesday, we feature two new episodes that focus on a different scandalous figure from history. If you enjoy today's episode, head over to the Famous Fates feed and subscribe. These episodes are free and only available on Spotify. In 1957, Bobby Fischer became the youngest ever U.S. chess champion at the age of only 14. Over the next 15 years, he would continue to dominate the chess world until one day he was gone. If you enjoy this episode, check out today's other episode on Molly Bloom, the poker princess who went all in running an elite underground poker ring until it all came crashing down. To hear it, head over to the Famous Fates feed on Spotify to listen for free today. This episode includes discussions of prejudice that some people may find offensive. We advise extreme caution for children under 13.
In 1974, 31-year-old Bobby Fischer was offered $5 million to play in a month-long chess tournament. But far from being excited at the prospect, the grandmaster was offended by the lowball offer. He said, "How dare they offer me $5 million for a month-long match? Ali received twice that much for one night."
Bold words from a chess player to a prize fighter, and Bobby's gripe wasn't even accurate. Muhammad Ali had recently received exactly $5 million for showing up to the famous Rumble in the Jungle match, the same amount Bobby would have gotten from the chess game. But facts often took a back seat for the hot-headed chess prodigy, particularly when his own inflated self-image came into play.
Bobby was also frustrated that the champion boxer was referring to himself as the greatest. He later said, "Ali stole that from me. I used the greatest for myself on television before he ever used it."
Although he was an exceptional chess player, some would argue that Bobby's greatness did not extend to his personality. He was once one of America's most extraordinary grand masters, but after a long, troubling decline, he went down in history as the game's most notorious disappointment.
Hi, I'm Vanessa Richardson.
And I'm Carter Roy.
And this is season two of Famous Fates, Falls from Grace. This season, we're examining once revered historical figures whose stories ended in less than savory ways. Every week, we're bringing you two episodes examining the lives of two fascinating people in the same industry.
They were beloved for their incredible accomplishments until they were reviled for their sins.
This week, we're covering Bobby Fischer, who at age 15 became the youngest international grandmaster in history. But after his historic world championship win in 1972, he disappeared from the chess world.
While he displayed signs of genius from a very young age, as an adult, Bobby retreated away from the game and further into his deeply complicated and insular mind.
We'll launch into Bobby Fischer's story right after this.
The NBA playoffs are here, and with FanDuel, your group chat's about to be going off. Because right now, new customers can bet $5 and get $150 in bonus bets if you win. And with live bets, your heart emojis will really be racing from tip-off to the final buzzer. Plus, when you win, you'll get paid faster than your friends can send you a victory gift. Or is it GIF? Who cares? You won! So get the word out to your crew and download FanDuel today. New customers bet $5 and get $150 in bonus bets if you win. Make every moment more with FanDuel, America's number one sportsbook. Official partner of the NBA.
21 plus and present in Ohio. First online real money wager only. $10 first deposit required. Bonus issued is non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire 7 days after receipt. See full terms at FanDuel.com/sportsbook. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Bobby Fischer stood out as soon as he walked into New York City's prestigious Marshall Chess Club on October 17, 1956. He wore unusually casual attire for a professional chess player, corduroy slacks and a plain t-shirt. But his age was what really set him apart. Bobby was just 13 years old.
After quickly taking to the game at the ripe old age of six, he had recently exploded onto the chess scene by winning the U.S. Junior Championship, and now he was ready to try his hand in the big leagues at the Rosenwald Memorial Tournament.
Despite being the youngest player there, Bobby was incredibly confident in his abilities. He talked a big game, boasting that he expected to beat his opponents, many of whom were nearly twice his age. But he got off to a rough start in the tournament. Bobby tied three matches and wasn't able to win a single game.
When it came time to play one of his final opponents, 25-year-old Donald Byrne, everyone gathered around to watch, eager to see if Bobby could finally pull off a victory. It wouldn't be easy. Byrne was regarded as one of the best chess players in America, having previously won the U.S. Open Championship. While other 13-year-olds might have cracked under this kind of pressure, Bobby was unfazed, determined to win.
The game started out well enough for Bobby, and he was able to gain a tactical advantage in only 11 turns. But then, in a move that shocked everyone, Bobby offered up his knight for the taking.
At first, Byrne and the tournament's spectators couldn't understand what sort of gameplay Bobby had in mind. It was either very smart or very foolish.
Soon, they realized what Bobby was up to. He deployed the Grunfeld defense, an obscure tactical approach that was rarely used in the competition circuit. According to chess biographer Frank Brady, it leads to a very different configuration as the game progresses, but Bobby still took the chance.
And the chance paid off. After several hours of playing, Bobby uttered his favorite of chess phrases, mate. Bobby had defeated Byrne, a previous U.S. Open champion. Yet the older player smiled down at his 13-year-old opponent as they shook hands, happy to have been a part of a game so significant and exciting.
The fact that someone so young had used an approach so genius garnered international attention. The match, which became known as the Game of the Century, went on to be studied in the chess world for years. Everyone believed that the Wonder Boy who'd won it had so much more to offer the game, and for a time, he did.
After his Game of the Century in 1956, Bobby's mother, Regina, stepped in to serve as his manager and help navigate his newfound fame. A single parent, she took on these duties in addition to the long shifts she worked as a nurse to support Bobby and his older sister, Joan.
As a poor kid from Brooklyn turned chess prodigy, Bobby's story was eagerly picked up by the media, and his precocious persona amplified his fame tenfold. After that first big tournament, he just kept winning.
In early 1958, Bobby became the youngest ever U.S. chess champion at age 14. After his win, his mother arranged for him to appear on the TV game show I've Got a Secret, where panelists are meant to guess the contestant's secret. No one on the panel knew that the gangly teen sitting before them was the best chess player in the United States.
One of the panelists asked whether Bobby's secret made people happy. Bobby tilted his head and said, "It made me happy."
But the title of American chess champion didn't appease Bobby for long. He had his sights set on an even grander title, chess champion of the world. And at the time, the finest chess players in the world weren't American. They were Russian, or to be more specific, Soviet.
With his mind made up, 15-year-old Bobby asked his mother to arrange a trip to Russia. His 20-year-old sister Joan would accompany him for the trip, while Regina would remain in New York for work.
Despite the continuing Cold War tensions between the USA and the USSR, the Russians were eager to host America's most promising young player. Some believed the Soviets' hospitality was an attempt to solidify Bobby's growing infatuation with their bloc, while others suspect it could have been an attempt to ease tensions between the two world superpowers.
Either way, when Bobby and Joan touched down in Moscow, they were given the royal treatment. A contingent from the USSR's chess section served as their hosts, hoping to show off their country's culture to the young Americans. They housed the siblings in an extravagant hotel suite with a view of the Red Square and were prepared to meet all of the young chess master's expectations. Little did they know that Bobby would be so hard to please.
In coming to Russia, Bobby's primary mission was to play as many chess masters as he could and to win. He wanted to prove to the Russians that he was not just on their level, but several tiers above. This would mean beating players like Mikhail Botvinnik, the standing world chess champion.
However, Bobby's Soviet hosts had different ideas of what his visit would look like. Planning to hold cultural trips and photo ops, not games. They had already let one of their most fearsome chess challengers behind the Iron Curtain. They weren't about to give him a sneak peek of the competition as well.
Bobby was undeterred when his host said that both of their top players were on summer holiday and unable to play him. Indignant, Bobby demanded that he at least play one of the country's top players. His hosts eventually wrangled a game with an international grandmaster, Tigran Petrosian.
But even that concession wasn't enough for Bobby. The 15-year-old wanted to be paid for his trouble. This was where his gracious Soviet hosts drew the line. When he asked how much money he would receive for playing against Petrosian, one of his hosts snapped, "None. You are our guest, and we don't pay fees to guests."
Bobby was irate, but he went ahead with the match anyway. He'd traveled halfway around the world to play the best, and he wasn't going to leave until he got a shot.
However, he soon realized that beating one of the most talented players in the world was easier said than done. Petrosian ended up winning a majority of their informal games, which only made Bobby even more furious, frustrated, and let's face it, probably a little embarrassed.
In Bobby's view, the Russia trip was a total failure. He felt that the USSR chess organization had intentionally undermined his position in the world rankings. Never mind that Bobby was the one who insisted on playing the games in the first place.
Bobby and his sister soon left Russia for Slovenia, where Bobby played in the Interzonal, his first ever international tournament. He bounced back relatively well from his losses in the USSR, and his global rating skyrocketed. As a result, the International Chess Organization, known by the French acronym FIDE, awarded Bobby with the title of Grand Master. At the time, 15-year-old Bobby was the youngest person ever to receive that honor.
While rising up the chess ranks, Bobby also became the youngest ever player to qualify for the Candidates Tournament. This critical step put him that much closer to his goal of defeating the Russians in the World Championship.
Bobby was so single-mindedly focused on becoming the best chess player in the world that at age 16, he decided to drop out of high school. His mother protested this decision, but she knew from experience that when Bobby set his mind to something, there was no convincing him otherwise.
Without the distraction of school, Bobby spent his time practicing around the clock. He would tell anyone who would listen, his mentors, competitors, and the general public, that not only was he going to make it to the world championship, he was going to win the whole thing. As an added bonus, this would mean dethroning his new Soviet enemies by breaking their decades-long winning streak.
But in 1959, Bobby fell short of his lofty goal. He was unable to secure first place at the Candidates Tournament, losing to future world champion Mikhail Tal. This meant that he was out of the running for chess's most prestigious match.
After his defeat on the world stage, Bobby became convinced that the Soviets were conspiring against him. He often saw them talking amongst themselves at the tournament and grew suspicious when his Russian opponents tied their matches instead of going for an outright win.
By tying, Bobby thought they were trying to ensure better overall scores by the end of the tournament, thus improving the odds that at least one Russian would be in the top bracket.
Following his loss, Bobby became even more convinced of his excellence and more paranoid about the Soviets and their alleged collusion. No matter how many years it took, he promised himself he would upset the Russians' world champion streak and claim the title as his own.
Coming up, Bobby reaches the peak of his career, only to fall right off.
Now, back to the story.
After making a huge splash in the chess world at the tender age of 13, chess genius Bobby Fischer floundered on the international stage in 1959. It stung even more that his losses usually came at the hands of Soviet competitors, whom he suspected of colluding against him.
Although his international gameplay wasn't yet up to snuff, Bobby was still young. He spent the rest of his teenage years practicing and dominating the American chess circuit. In 1964, the 20-year-old Bobby won all 11 of his games in the U.S. Championship. To this day, he remains the only person to have achieved this feat.
After his perfect score run in the States, the chess world was eager to see Bobby try again for the World Championship, but not everyone was a fan. As his mastery of the game intensified, so did his reputation for being snobbish and hypersensitive.
Before agreeing to participate in a tournament, Bobby had to approve all of the competition's trappings, from the size of the prize purse right down to what material the chessboard was made of and when the game started. Bobby was a notoriously late sleeper and wouldn't accept a start time before noon.
At least some of Bobby's hypersensitivity could be attributed to a physical condition called hyperacusis. According to Bobby's biographer, Frank Brady, hyperacusis is an acute sensitivity to noise and even distant sounds.
While at the board, Bobby couldn't stand the slightest sound, and although audience members were meant to be completely quiet, the occasional shifting seat or covered cough could send Bobby into a tailspin. Although he would usually play through the entirety of a game once he sat down, it would take a great deal of negotiating to get Bobby to sit in the first place. He often acted as if he were king, and while many were willing to serve as pawns in his game, there were some who refused to bow to his whims.
These holdouts included the Russians, whom Bobby openly despised. On August 20th, 1962, Bobby published an accusatory article in Sports Illustrated called "The Russians Have Fixed World Chess." In the article, Bobby proclaimed that he would never participate in a candidates' tournament again because the game was rigged. He wrote, "The system set up by FIDE ensures that there will always be a Russian world champion. The Russians arranged it that way."
Bobby was playing with fire by taking on the Soviet Union. They owned the chess world and probably had the power to ban him from it. But when the Russian Chess Federation caught wind that Bobby had accused them of cheating, they just wrote it off as the paranoid ramblings of a petulant young man.
Bobby held on to the belief that he had always been the world's best, even though he failed to secure the official title. But it was all just talk until he could prove his mettle in competition.
And soon he did. Throughout 1971, Bobby demolished his opponents in several international tournaments. He also went on to sweep his candidates' matches, which he ended up playing in despite his bluff about boycotting. After several false starts, the 28-year-old Bobby officially qualified for the World Championship in the summer of 1971.
Bobby was set to play the reigning champion, Boris Spassky, the next summer. But of course, Bobby had some conditions that would need to be met if he was going to play at all.
Leading up to the game, Bobby paid several visits to FIDE president Max Yua, laying out his long list of demands. First, there was the question of venue. Bobby originally wanted the games to take place in Belgrade, Yugoslavia, but others favored Reykjavik, Iceland. Bobby eventually accepted Iceland as the host country, but only if the prize fund was increased substantially.
When the World Championship match began in July of 1972, Bobby failed to show up.
A day passed, and then another, and still there was no sign of Bobby.
The match seemed to be falling apart. That is, until a British financier stepped in, offering an extra $125,000 to double the existing prize purse. This made the winnings equivalent to about $1.5 million today.
It seemed like Bobby would get everything he wanted. Not only was he finally playing for the World Championship, like he'd always dreamed of, if he won, he stood to make a small fortune. And yet, he still needed one last push into the match.
Just when it seemed like he was going to forfeit, Bobby got a call that changed his mind. On the other end of the line was soon-to-be Secretary of State Henry Kissinger. He introduced himself a little more casually, saying, "This is the worst chess player in the world calling the best chess player in the world."
Kissinger personally asked Bobby to go to Iceland and take down his Russian opponent. He ended their 10-minute conversation by saying, "The United States government wishes you well, and I wish you well."
No pressure.
With that call, Bobby felt important. He was more than just a chess player. He was a representative of the United States of America on the world stage. For him, this level of prestige was an even greater motivator than cash. After Kissinger's intervention, Bobby decided to show up at the World Championship. But of course, showing up was only half the battle. He still had to win the thing.
Bobby arrived in Iceland in the early morning hours so as to avoid the press hordes. He was shuttled to his high-end hotel and slept well into the day, as was his habit. On July 11th, Bobby's World Championship match against Boris Spassky finally began.
After all of the build-up to his big moment, Bobby lost the first game. As was his custom, he blamed his losses on the match's conditions. This time around, he couldn't stand the cameras in the corners of the playing hall, and he was irritated by how close the audience was to the table. Before the second game, Bobby said he would forfeit if the conditions weren't changed to his satisfaction.
When the match's organizers failed to immediately implement Bobby's demands, the American was a no-show for the second game, and it was declared a forfeiture. In order to prevent the complete unraveling of the contest, officials swiftly granted Bobby's last-minute requests, arranging for the next game to be played in a smaller back room. With all his demands met, Bobby's play began to improve.
After 41 moves, the match was adjourned for the evening. Bobby was so pleased with his powerful position on the board that he agreed to play the remainder of the game on the main stage when they returned the following day. However, after a night of contemplation, Bobby's opponent, Spassky, realized he couldn't turn the board in his favor, and Bobby was declared the winner of Game 3.
The tournament went forward without another serious incident. Concentrating on the game itself served Bobby well. He ended up winning 6 of the next 18 games, drawing 11, and losing only 1. He ultimately won the tournament, officially becoming the 11th World Chess Champion.
Bobby had finally achieved his lifelong dream. He had broken the Soviet's 24-year-long winning streak, and the win became a watershed moment in Cold War-era American propaganda.
Bobby returned home to the States a hero. According to his biographer, Frank Brady, More than 1,000 well-wishers gathered at the steps of City Hall as New York's Mayor John Lindsay awarded Bobby with a gold medal and proclaimed him the grandest master of them all.
Upon his return, a citywide Bobby Fischer Day was organized. He was asked to appear in all sorts of media outlets, from Sports Illustrated to the Dick Cavett Show. As a result of his nationwide press, membership in the U.S. Chess Federation nearly doubled in 1972. This rise in popularity for the game is often referred to as the Fischer Boom.
Bobby had changed the game for good, especially in the United States, and the public was eagerly waiting to see what he would do next. But it appeared the reigning world chess champion didn't have any moves left.
After winning the championship in 1972, 29-year-old Bobby disappeared from competitive chess. He moved to Los Angeles and spent the next year without playing a single professional game.
Once he stepped out of the spotlight, the public's perception of Bobby as an eccentric misanthrope took hold. Adding to his snobbish, high-maintenance persona were his prejudiced remarks about the Russians and, soon enough, the Jewish people.
Bobby was born into a Jewish family, but didn't grow up practicing the faith. Instead, as a young man, Bobby was indoctrinated into the Worldwide Church of God, a contemporary Christian denomination founded by American advertising executive Herbert W. Armstrong.
Bobby's finances were also tied up in the church. Over the years, he donated a large amount of his earnings, even a hefty percentage of his world championship prize, to Armstrong and his disciples.
During his period of semi-retirement, Bobby became even more deeply involved in the church and began to consume books denouncing the Jewish people. Despite the church's claims that it preaches love and unity, Bobby fell into a hole of hatred, one that was growing deeper by the day.
Soon, even his relationship with the Worldwide Church of God crumbled. He eventually left the church in the mid-70s, citing disputes with the organization's leadership, particularly over money.
Money had always been a contentious topic for Bobby, especially during his post-championship retirement. A whole assortment of financial offers were made to him throughout the 70s, but he refused almost every single one. He always found something that he deemed unsatisfactory about the arrangement.
Warner Brothers, for instance, offered Bobby $1 million to record a series of chess lessons. But he ended up rejecting the deal altogether because he didn't like the sound of his own voice. And he refused to allow a professional actor to read the audio for him.
In 1975, Bobby was meant to defend his title as world champion. But yet again, there was a showdown about the conditions around the game. Bobby gave the FIDE an ultimatum. Either they met his demands, or he would forfeit the match. He'd used this tactic before and had come out on top, so he believed the same would happen again.
But this go-around, FIDE refused to give in to many of Bobby's rules and specifications. True to his word, Bobby refused to play, and the world champion title was passed to Anatoly Karpov of the Soviet Union.
Bobby's forfeiture confirmed what the chess world had long feared. Their prodigal American son was lost.
Up next, Bobby Fischer goes from American chess hero to exiled fugitive.
Now, back to the story.
After winning the World Chess Championship at age 29 in 1972, Bobby Fischer left competitive chess, seemingly for good.
Tucked away in a dark little apartment in Los Angeles, an increasingly disturbed Bobby absorbed neo-Nazi ideologies. He'd always been paranoid, but now even his circle of trusted friends shrank as he grew to believe that the whole world was out to get him.
Bobby roamed L.A. in a kind of haze, jumping from Pasadena to downtown, often staying in cramped quarters that he was ashamed of. He did nothing to try and change his situation, even though he had every opportunity. Bobby was just too stubborn, snobbish, and paranoid.
He believed that everyone was trying to exploit him, and to a certain extent, he had a point. The media, corporations, and chess federations all wanted to make money off of Bobby's name. But as his fame reached a plateau and his earnings tapered off, Bobby was the one who seemed to be doing the exploiting. He was forced to borrow money from family and what few friends he had left. He even dipped into his aging mother's social security checks.
While living off the generosity of his friends, many of whom were Jewish, Bobby somehow became an even more staunch anti-Semite. Starting in the 1980s, Bobby often made anti-Semitic comments during the few interviews he gave, ranging from alleging that he was the victim of a Jewish conspiracy to denying the Holocaust ever happened.
Eventually, his paranoia extended to the U.S. government. Bobby had decades worth of unpaid back taxes he owed the IRS, and now that his funds were diminishing, he blamed the American government, along with the Russians and Jewish people, for his plight.
As he grew older, Bobby rarely, if ever, took accountability for his own sad state of affairs. There was always something or someone out to get him. Some have argued that, in all likelihood, Bobby's constantly paranoid state was driven by mental illness. No one can know for sure, as he was never diagnosed, but it didn't take a medical professional to see that Bobby had become a shell of his once confident self.
Bobby's colleagues have said that during these years, he was more than simply hateful. He was fearful. He suspected that he was the target of a clandestine assassination plot, either by the KGB or the Israelis.
Bobby was so paranoid that he changed his name, going by a pseudonym and telling people who wrote to him to never reveal his address to anyone. Over time, Bobby's fan base began to shrink alongside his narrowing mindset and fading spotlight.
Yet, in a twist of events, it was one of his fans, 17-year-old Zita Raichani, that helped motivate Bobby to return to the game. In the early 90s, Zita, one of Hungary's most talented young chess players, began a correspondence with the 47-year-old Bobby.
Bobby, an isolated and depraved middle-aged man, became obsessed with her. But Zita waved off Bobby's proclamations of love and focused on convincing him to return to the chess world.
In July of 1992, Zita and several Eastern European chess officials flew to Los Angeles to talk Bobby into a potential comeback match in Yugoslavia. Surprising everyone, including himself, Bobby agreed to the tournament and its $5 million purse, perhaps because he was tired of being in the shadows or desperate to fix his financial situation.
Prior to September of 1992, Bobby flew into Sveti Stefan, Yugoslavia, excited to reclaim his spotlight. But as soon as he arrived, the U.S. Department of Treasury sent him a cease and desist letter asking that he immediately leave.
Bobby was actively flouting the U.S.'s sanctions against Yugoslavia. The country's sitting government had committed atrocious war crimes and human rights violations against people vying for independence. Bobby's visit, never mind the huge profit he stood to make from it, was in violation of the U.S.'s foreign policies.
The cease and desist notice was a long way from the patriotic praise that Kissinger had given Bobby two decades prior, and Bobby's response to it was just as stark a comparison. While answering questions at a press conference for the tournament, Bobby held up the letter and spat on it.
After this incident, all eyes were on Bobby, keen to see just how much more had changed about the former American chess patriot. The tournament itself would be a throwback to his glory days, with Bobby rematching his longtime rival, Boris Spassky.
The games were hard-fought and evenly matched, with a hefty number of ties between the aged Bobby and Boris. But in the end, Bobby won the tournament, briefly restoring the chess world's faith in their fallen hero. As a prize, he received around $3 million, pulling him out of poverty.
However, following his comeback that summer, Bobby found himself on the precipice of his greatest loss, that of his country. On December 15, 1992, a U.S. grand jury indicted him for violating economic sanctions against Yugoslavia. The U.S. government issued a warrant for his arrest in Belgrade.
Bobby immediately fled to a small northern Serbian town called Majer Kanija. He picked the town for its quiet surroundings and proximity to the Hungarian border in case he needed to make a quick escape.
Completely alone, Bobby remained in Majer Kanija for months, growing bored by his limited surroundings, but feeling secure in his anonymity. However, this soon wasn't enough for Bobby, and he had to leave the small town for Budapest, Hungary.
He remained in Budapest for nearly 8 years. During his exile in Europe, his mother passed away. Bobby was devastated and was desperate to go to the funeral, but he couldn't risk getting arrested. Then, just months after his mother passed, Bobby's sister died too. Again, Bobby was forced to stay away and mourn his only family from a distance. He felt trapped and afraid he would remain so for the rest of his life.
In 1997, with his passport set to expire, Bobby drove to Bern, Switzerland to secure a new one. Despite the fact that the U.S. had a warrant out for his arrest, he was able to obtain a new U.S. passport, which was valid until 2007.
With the new passport in hand, and the authorities apparently off his tail, Bobby's behavior became even more erratic. In 2000, he left Budapest for Tokyo, Japan. There, he stayed with an old flame, Miyoko Watai, the president of the Japanese Chess Association. Bobby, now 56, struck up a relationship with Miyoko, but he was often unfaithful.
Bobby became obsessed with having a child, but Miyoko was in her 50s, past childbearing age. So in the early 2000s, Bobby began traveling to the Philippines, seeking a young woman there who might bear him children.
On September 11, 2001, while on one of his many trips, Bobby was interviewed by Radio Baguio in the Philippines. The MC asked for his comment on the terrorist attacks on the World Trade Center and Pentagon. Bobby said, "Yes, well, this is all wonderful news. It's time to finish off the U.S. once and for all."
Bobby's words were heard around the world. The wanted fugitive who had been living relatively freely was now back in the limelight, and the U.S. government renewed their efforts to track Bobby down and extradite him.
In 2004, while Bobby was leaving Japan for the Philippines, he was arrested in the Tokyo Narita Airport. After being held for hours, the Japanese authorities told him that he was under arrest for trying to use a void U.S. passport.
Bobby was aghast. His passport had at least 3 more years until it expired, at least on paper. But behind the scenes, the American government had made some moves to put Bobby in checkmate.
The State Department rendered his passport void in an attempt to strand him and perhaps persuade the Japanese government to extradite him.
In an effort to convince officials to let him go, Bobby married his on-again-off-again partner, Miyoko, a Japanese national. But it was going to take more than a marriage certificate to get him out of his situation. Before he could enter Japan and apply for a spouse visa, he still needed a new country to claim him and provide a valid passport.
Over the years, Bobby had alienated several sovereign nations, but there was one country that was willing to throw him a bone: Iceland.
According to his biographer, Frank Brady, as a result of the 1972 World Championship match, Fischer had more to do with promoting Iceland than anyone in modern times. They had the ability as a people not only to offer him asylum, but to secure it and extricate him from prison.
In the end, the Nordic nation did just that in 2005, offering Bobby citizenship and flying him to Reykjavik, Iceland, at no cost.
At first, Bobby was grateful to the Icelandic people for having freed him. But as with all of his relationships, he slowly grew mistrustful and loathsome. After a year of living in Reykjavik, a small city of nearly 120,000 people, he started to feel trapped.
Miyoko was able to visit Bobby for 2 weeks at a time, but because of her work, she continued to live in Japan. Bobby, meanwhile, remained in Reykjavik for nearly 3 years, constantly complaining about his situation. Adding to his endless list of grievances were a series of urinary problems, which he began experiencing by the end of 2007.
Bobby had held a decades-long skepticism about modern medicine and initially refused to see a doctor. Sadly, when Bobby eventually did decide to see a health professional, his kidneys were in danger of complete failure. Even with the grim warnings of his doctors, he refused treatment. On January 17, 2008, Bobby Fischer died of kidney failure.
When he first came onto the scene at age 13, Bobby Fischer's genius was filled with promise. But that promise was categorically broken as the years wore on.
Exiled from the country he once loved but came to hate, Bobby died at age 64. Coincidentally, 64 also happens to be the total number of squares on a chessboard.
From his early wins to his late losses, Bobby's game was a lonely one, all the way up to its sudden and final end. Thanks again for tuning in to Falls from Grace. For more information on Bobby Fischer, amongst the many sources we used, we found Endgame, Bobby Fischer's Remarkable Rise and Fall from America's Brightest Prodigy to the Edge of Madness by Frank Brady, extremely helpful to our research. We'll be back next week with two more episodes.
You can find more episodes of Falls from Grace and all other Parcast originals for free on Spotify. We'll be back next week with another story of remarkable success and even more remarkable downfall.
Falls from Grace was created by Max Cutler and is a Parcast Studios original. Executive producers include Max and Ron Cutler. Sound design by Brendan Hawkins, with production assistance by Ron Shapiro, Carly Madden, and Joshua Kern. This episode of Falls from Grace was written by Justine Bede, with writing assistance by Kate Gallagher, and stars Vanessa Richardson and Carter Roy.